Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, the University of Chicago sent a controversial welcome letter to the class of 2020. Our commitment to academic freedom, it said, means we do not support so-called trigger warnings or the creation of intellectual safe spaces. It was the latest in a nationwide debate around speech on college campuses, microaggressions, administrative firings, calls to defund student newspapers. This hour on Point, political correctness at the University of Chicago and beyond. You can join us on air or online. College students, what do you see happening on campus? Should there be safe spaces, trigger warnings? What is the university's role in moderating intellectual debate in the classroom? Joining us now from Chicago is Stephanie Green. She's a senior majoring in English at the University of Chicago, and she's president of the Organization of Black Students, a Chicago native. Stephanie Green, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Also from Chicago, Cosmo Albrecht joins us. He's a junior majoring in public policy at the university. From San Antonio, Texas, he's the community and government liaison for student government and a member of the student organization Chicago Student Action, which has coordinated a number of campus protests. Cosmo Albrecht, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, John.
And from Chicago, Charles Lipson also joins us. He's a professor of political science at the university. Charles Lipson, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Professor, let me start by asking you to trace the history of what we are calling political correctness since you've been on the University of Chicago campus starting in 1977. Is it different now?
It is. Although the university's basic position has always been the same, in the late 1960s, when student protests were really ferocious on all campuses, the University of Chicago commissioned a report from its faculty. It's called the Calvin Report, and what it said was, the university encourages free speech, and it doesn't take any political positions as a university in order that the faculty and the students might do so. Jeff Stone, former dean of the law school and provost number two at the university for a long time, wrote a follow-up to that a couple of years ago. What I had started saying two or three years ago in writing about publicly was that although those were our principles, they weren't being enforced on the ground. They weren't the administrators who went around weren't making sure that things didn't get interrupted. If they were interrupted, there weren't any consequences for them, and that we needed to move not only to set up the rules of the road, we needed to explain to our students what would happen. And I think one of the culminating points was last year, one student introduced a free speech resolution to the student government, and it was voted down in large part because people said, well, this would mean you couldn't shut down speeches that you didn't like. And if you're in a kind of minority position, I don't mean that you're a racial minority or religious minority, but just in a minority position, you wouldn't be able to shut down speeches you didn't like. Well, that's precisely why these rules were needed. And that was the background to it. And I've been pushing for it. So I think this is a good thing. Maybe the letter was worded in a little infelicitous way. But I mean, the basic message is absolutely right.
Do you think, Professor, that the letter purposely had an edge to it, a little chip on its shoulder?
It may have. It's hard to know what people's ideas were. For example, in saying we don't support safe spaces, we should have been absolutely clear that anybody who is threatened or if there's any real danger to safety, those people will be protected. That's crucial, and that is a university responsibility. I think the word that kind of got left out in the way that people read it was the word intellectual. Intellectual safe spaces won't be guaranteed, and that's critically important. If there aren't ideas at the university that that occasionally make you uncomfortable, we're just not doing our job. Free speech is important, not only for the usual reasons, but because it's important for our teaching, learning, and research. That's what's critical.
Stephanie, how do you react to Professor Lipson and to the letter?
So I thought that, first of all, I thought that the letter was poorly worded. I think the quotes, quotation marks around trigger warnings and safe spaces kind of aim to make it seem like these were concepts that aren't real and that help address very real needs for students.
But the university was making fun of those ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. I 100% feel that way. In reference to what Professor Lipson said, I mean, I totally agree that, you know, if students aren't feeling uncomfortable in the classroom sometimes, like, then universities aren't doing their job. However, I think that, you know, it's within a student's right to, you know, ask a professor for a trigger warning or something like that if it means that they will be able to fully participate in class that way.
Now, I want to try to help people understand a little bit about the terms that we're using, like trigger warning. And I want to play a little piece of sound from 2014. It was from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a student urged her university to add trigger warnings to some classrooms. And here's how she explained it to Reason Magazine.
I was in a classroom. It was a very small, intimate classroom. And we were watching a film. And there were several scenes of sexual assault, and finally a very drawn-out rape scene. It did not trigger me. I recognized the potential for it to be very triggering.
Cosmo, do you recognize that sentiment, and do you agree with it?
Absolutely, and I think that a key part of the academic freedom that the university wants to uphold is giving professors the discretion to use trigger warnings in the classroom and to offer sort of warning to students if sensitive content is going to be presented. And to me, what the letter did is take a position on trigger warnings that prescribes to faculty a specific way of teaching or not teaching. And that bothers me because I see academic freedom as requiring professors to have discretion in the classrooms. And when administrators are sort of butting in and saying, suggesting that that trigger warnings harm students' ability to learn and to face challenging ideas, that it, to me, undermines the concept of academic freedom because academic freedom entails professors having discretion.
Professor Lipson, when you hear the clip that I just played from that student in California and hear Stephanie and Cosmo talk about their views on trigger warnings, do you think this very concept is a frivolous one?
Not at all. I agreed with everything that they said, and I thought that that's why your question was a good one. There may have been a little chip on their shoulder. I think that the university did not intend in any way to prevent professors from saying this. What they really meant was that the university was not itself going to be setting up these kind of spaces. Professors could do whatever they want. I teach
courses. So not prohibiting them, but also not encouraging them.
Letting professors do exactly what Cosmo said, I'm going to be teaching a course next year on wars. The whole course is a giant trigger warning in a sense, and I can't know in a large class who might be affected by any one thing that I'm saying. I think that it's good practice to go ahead and say it, but I don't think I should be disciplined if I didn't say it. I do think that the issue of administrators interfering is precisely what does happen on many campuses. They come marching in to deal with professors if the professors don't say what the administrators want. And that happens all the time. There were story after story last year of professors at different colleges, not at the University of Chicago, it could never happen here, but at different colleges who had been warned by administrators that they had said something that one student found disturbing, and it was often content, not even triggering issues. By the way, the basic issue with triggering is psychological anxiety, disturbance, all those things. And universities have a real obligation to provide confidential mental health support for any student who might need it. This is not something that universities should avoid, and it's not something that a professor of political science can do. My wife worked for a number of years at student mental health facility, and she is a clinician in private practice. That's what clinicians do, and that's perfectly fine. So I agree with Stephanie and Cosmo in this regard.
Stephanie, let me ask you this question. The reason I asked Professor Lipson if the term trigger warning was frivolous is that I know, because I've heard it in conversation with people my age, I'm in my 50s, who hear the term trigger warning and say, boy, some kids want to be babied in college, and that's nuts. How do you react to that?
I totally disagree with that. I don't think that we want to be babied in college. I think a lot of the – there's more discussion now, I think, about mental health on campuses, and I think that that's really important. And trigger warnings totally fall into this – you know, under this umbrella of mental health discussions. So, I mean, I think that students who do have kind of mental health, you know, issues, or they know that they, like, something is going to be triggering for them – like, it's not that they want to be baby. They want to be able to participate to the full extent that they can. And I think that that's, like, really important that universities kind of accommodate students in that sense, because, like, mental health is – it's very serious, and we want students to graduate from the University of Chicago as, you know, healthy individuals.
Can I ask you a question, Stephanie?
Yes.
Last year, following up on John, last year at Columbia – students in a class on Greek myths wanted trigger warnings before all the Greek myths. Frivolous or not?
Stephanie, hold that thought. We'll be right back, and I'll get to your answer on that. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, the University of Chicago sent a freshman welcome letter rejecting political correctness on campus, including trigger warnings and safe spaces. We're looking at both sides. You can join the conversation. Are college campuses still places for intellectual discourse, unpopular minority opinions? Do free speech and inclusive communities have to be in opposition? We're talking with University of Chicago students Stephanie Green and Cosmo Albrecht and University of Chicago political science professor Charles Lipson. Stephanie,
yes.
Take a crack at the question you just got from Professor Lipson.
Sure. So I hesitate to say that any request from a student is frivolous in terms of trigger warnings. So I did not hear anything about the Columbia students' request. So, you know, I don't know their lives. I don't know if they've all experienced, like, trauma, and they all need trigger warnings. So I would never say that, like, their request was frivolous.
Cosmo, I want to ask you a question related to something that Stephanie alluded to a moment ago. She talked about mental illness as being the – and protecting mental illness as being the motivation for this. But
sure.
Isn't some of this debate defining more broadly and placing this in the context of hurt feelings rather than actual mental illness and trying to protect people from being even offended in a minor way that wouldn't rise to the level of mental illness?
Sure. I think on some college campuses in some contexts, we have observed situations in which there are students who, you know, don't want to confront certain ideas and want to, avoid certain content. But I don't think that's a conversation that we've had at the University of Chicago at all. So when I look at the letter from Dean Ellison and I think about the way that trigger warnings and safe spaces function at the U of C, I don't see a situation in which there are students en masse requesting to be shielded from certain ideas or requesting to have their feelings protected. The limited uses of trigger warnings that I've seen requested at U of C have been about offering students with mental health issues an opportunity to be included in the classroom fully and to be alerted of material that may be legitimately and seriously traumatic for them.
And I don't think that's a problem. I don't think that's a problem, actually,
sure. So,
in real classes. Do you, Cosmo?
I don't think it's a problem. No, but the letter sort of insinuates that any use of quote unquote trigger warnings is a breach of academic freedom. That
no,
to believe
it does
in
not,
the use
it
of trigger
does
warnings.
Not. It doesn't insinuate that, in my opinion. I think it just says that it may have taken too strong a position on that. But I think the big issue is that we had three talks shut down last year, two of them by pro-Palestinian groups, invited people in from off campus. There were people who were speaking on a kind of pro-Zionist side. And in one case, legitimate protests, just fine. In one case, however, they didn't like what was going on. Their protests, they didn't feel like had disrupted it. So they took out a bullhorn and started shouting over it.
So, Professor Lipson, how do you define legitimate protest? I'm just curious how you're defining that in this context.
I define it as anything that would be permitted under the First Amendment other than shouting down and disrupting other people. So I don't mind at all people walking around with signs. I don't mind them holding a counter event. I don't mind them asking the toughest questions they can at the event. When they start threatening people, when they start using a bullhorn to shout over and disrupt, when they and this has happened multiple times, and it doesn't happen as much at the University of Chicago as elsewhere, but I think a lot of times the people who are against free speech are actually using a lot of these issues as ways of bullying people into taking their position. And if they don't, they actually want to disrupt they want to disrupt them. So I don't see the University of Chicago's position as being somehow a pretzel-like position that's designed to suppress speech. It's an old-fashioned 19th century John Stuart Mill liberal position that we want different kinds of speech. Let you speak on your side, Cosmo or Stephanie. Let me speak on my side. And let the best argument win.
Guys, as you imagine, we've got plenty of callers, and I want to take one right now. We've got Steve on the line from Houghton, Michigan. Steve, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I understand the perspectives being put forth here, but my sense of it, and I attended the University of Wisconsin in the 80s. My sense of the issue is college prepares people for the adult world. And in the adult world, we don't get to cherry pick the stimuli that we have to encounter. We may see an auto accident. We may witness a mother striking a child, things that we find intolerable or reprehensible. And we, part of what college does is provide coping skills, the development of coping skills. Now, I agree that a woman who has been sexually abused should not be forced to participate in a class that involves a film about rape. But that, to me, falls better under the heading of one-on-one counseling rather than a broad-brush, opt-out sort of philosophy. I think that one-on-one counseling as a mental health tool is more appropriate in that type of instance.
Steve, that's a fascinating point, and I want to direct it to Stephanie. Stephanie, do you have any concern that the more students push for trigger warning, safe spaces, they set themselves up for feeling unsafe when they leave the college and get out in the real world?
I do not. I think that when students are seeking kind of safe spaces or the use of trigger warnings in class, it's really so that, like, we can learn. You know, when we think about, like, the adult world, I'm also not paying $65,000 a year to, you know, walk down the street. So, like, at the end of the day, like, I think that, you know, for that price tag and for what I'm going to college for, which is to learn, right, like, I want to be able to do so in a way that allows me to take in as much information as I can.
Cosmo, do you see it that way? Is it about the money that you're putting on the table to attend the college, and in return for that, you want certain considerations? Is that what this is about?
Sure, I think that's part of it. I think a part of it is also recognizing that students come from a variety of different lived experiences, a variety of different backgrounds, and that these mechanisms of offering safe spaces and trigger warnings to students allow for students who are from non-traditional backgrounds to feel welcome and to feel included in the classroom. And I think what's sort of ironic about this letter is that in many other contexts, the University of Chicago already offers safe spaces and trigger warnings, as a part of, a push to make the university more compliant with Title IX, for instance. The university has implemented a Dean on Call program, which gives students a safe space to talk about sexual assault with, a licensed administrator. Same goes for LGBTQ students. There's actually an extensive training for virtually all faculty that sort of teaches faculty how to be allies to LGBT students. So I think it's sort of
what fallacious. If I don't want to be an ally? What in fact the I shouldn't be able to assault somebody, but what if I don't want to be an ally? Is that my free speech right? Of course it is, as long as I'm treating the students fairly, not grading them differently. And the fact is, it was the deans on call who shut down orderly talks last year because they had decided enough is enough. The disruptors had already been taken out of the room. The thing was going on. It was the deans on call who actually shut it down. What about the safe spaces that occur at a party, a fraternity party, in which it's going to be serving tacos and people are wearing sombreros? It's the deans on call who actually come in and interfere with those, quote, safe spaces. In other words, what has been eliminated as part of this is all of what we call civil society. That is the private spaces that students can and should be able to set up. By the way, I want to just say I completely agree with what Steve from Michigan said. I thought he put it in exactly the right way.
Professor, political science professor Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago, I know your time is short and we've got to let you go. I want to thank you for joining us today.
It's absolutely my pleasure. And the kind of discussion that we just had and the disagreements and areas of agreement that I had with Stephanie and Cosmo are exactly what the University of Chicago wants. It couldn't make me prouder to be a professor and part of the university when I hear students like Stephanie and Cosmo feel absolutely free to push back against me. Believe me, there's not a problem with my students pushing back against me. They're more than capable of doing it.
I do believe you, Professor. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, I want to bring another voice into the conversation. That's Jonathan Chait. He's a writer for New York Magazine who's written extensively on political correctness on college campuses. His piece last year in the magazine, Not a Very PC Thing to Say, was widely debated. Jonathan Chait, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, John.
Let me start by asking you to characterize what you consider the nut of the issue. Is it about what goes on in classrooms with students seeking protection, warning, that sort of thing from academic material? Or is it more about the interaction between students and others who come to campus who might be the object of protests or attempts to get them uninvited, that sort of thing?
I think it's all those things. And as one of the students just noted, the university does commit itself to maintaining safe spaces for LGBTQ students and other people who might need a place where they can sort of be free of the culture of debate and argument that is sort of the real hallmark of what a university is about. So I don't see Chicago's letter as saying it's going to dismantle these safe spaces. I think what it's saying is it doesn't want to allow the logic of safety to override the ability to hold free discussions in other places, both within the classroom and in other parts of the campus where people hold debates.
Did you consider the letter an entirely reasonable message to students?
Well, I think to the extent that it left itself open to being misconstrued, it may not have worded itself the best possible way. So clearly they are maintaining safe spaces. So to say that they're against safe spaces allowed people to say, well, what do you mean? But I think what their intent is completely laudable. And what their intent is obviously to say, we're not going to allow the logic of safe spaces to override people's right to free expression.
Now, we talked about definition of terms, and I want to take on the issue of microaggressions. We've got a little bit of sound here. 2014, Harvard student Kimiko Matsuda Lawrence wrote and directed the play I, Too, Am Harvard about microaggressions on her campus. She explained to the New York Times why that was important.
It's important to have the vocabulary to be able to, like, describe your lived experiences in order to feel like they're justified, because people are always trying to dismiss them. Right. We have to show that, like, these little daily microaggressions are just, like, sort of the little bubbling up of greater racial tensions that are, like, underlying this whole post-racial, like, if we have this post-racial surface, there's, like, all of these extreme racial tensions underneath the surface.
Stephanie Green, does that Harvard student speak for you?
Yeah. I think that, you know, going to the University of Chicago and being a Black student here, you know, microaggressions are something that I experience quite often. And it's, you know, it's something that...
Can you give me an example of one that you've experienced or multiple ones that you've experienced?
Sure. So, I mean, I'm from Chicago. So it's kind of the assumption, oh, I'm from the South Side. Oh, you know, maybe I'm low income. Maybe I'm from the ghetto. Like, all of these things that people kind of, like, assume about you and, like, your background and your family, just kind of based on like, one little tidbit of information, and then they kind of run wild with it.
And why is that a microaggression rather than just normal human interaction and people learning about one another and drawing certain conclusions from certain characteristics and then learning different information?
Sure. So I think that the difference is that it's their views of me, like, rely on stereotypes, on things that they've heard. They're not giving me kind of, like, the opportunity to tell them, like, who I am, right? So they just hear one thing about me, and then suddenly they have a full idea of who I am. And it's not fun to experience those sorts of things.
Is that, Cosmo, an experience that is unique to minority students, or is that a universal phenomenon that applies to whites as well as Blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and others?
Well, I certainly think there's a legacy of racial discrimination, of gender discrimination, of class discrimination in this country, and I think that manifests
campuses. Of course there is, but Stephanie was talking about people making assumptions about other people.
Based on
where she's from.
Certainly, and I think that is a form of stereotyping and a form of racist prejudice that, can make students feel left out of conversations. And, you know, in this discussion about free speech and about, you know, the open exchange of ideas, we have to take into consideration that, you know, there are many people for whom free speech was not accessible. Universities didn't admit students of color, didn't admit women, right? These are histories, and these are existing power dynamics that make the conversation about free speech more nuanced than the Chicago Letter stipulates, right? There is a history, and there is a legacy, and there is a power dynamic at work that makes certain students feel and legitimately be at a disadvantage. And I think that's something that you can't sweep under the rug. I very much think that is a part of the conversation about free speech and free expression, because, you know, those concepts and those values haven't been ones that people have had access to historically.
Jonathan Chade, is this something, an issue that has been continuously boiling since, say, you were at the University of Michigan, or do you think this issue has become much worse or much larger, I should say, in the last couple of years?
No, I don't think it's been continuously boiling. There was a big upsurge in political correctness in the late 80s and early 90s, and it went away pretty quickly. And when I reported the piece that you referenced before for New York, and I was speaking to professors who were sort of my perspective and generation, you know, liberals who went to college in the early 90s, and they told me something changed rapidly around 2014, where the culture of the campus just transformed. And all of a sudden, they were back into the early 90s, and they didn't really understand where this had come from.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about free speech, protest, and political correctness on college campus. You can join the conversation. Can we cultivate open inquiry and discourse without hurting people's feelings? At what point should we care about hurt feelings? We're talking with University of Chicago students Stephanie Green and Cosmo Albrecht and New York Magazine writer Jonathan Chait. As I mentioned, we've got a lot of people waiting on the line to talk, and we're going to go right to Alex, who is calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. Alex, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. Yeah, so I teach at a few different state schools, commuter school, and when I hear this topic come up, it seems like it's because of something that happened at University of Chicago, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, real top-tier schools. My students it doesn't really seem to be on their radar. They're more interested in topics of college affordability, student loan debt, stuff like that. So my question for the panelists would be, do they think that this gets, maybe it's being talked about as more widespread of an issue than it is?
Jonathan Chait, let me ask you this. Are we exaggerating what happens on a few high-achieving elite campuses with pampered rich kids that don't reflect the broader higher education universe?
One, I'd say yes. Two, I'd say these campuses have always had a disproportionate effect on the culture, so they're worth paying disproportionate attention to. And three, I would say the debate has been somewhat inaccurately framed as a problem of higher education, when I think it's really a problem of left discourse, that there's a sort of new ideological approach on the left that does not allow open discourse on some of these issues, and it's working its will in places where it has the power to impose its ideological hegemony, and campuses are among, but not limited to, those places. So I think you can find other spaces, communities and organizations where the same kind of problems are appearing themselves, but that aren't college campuses.
That's interesting, because I was looking back at Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind. He was a University of Chicago professor, wrote that in 1987, and he blamed higher education. You're saying this problem is not either created by higher education or confined to college campuses.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think it is confined to campuses, and I don't think it's a problem of higher education. And I think Alan Bloom was sort of dragging some of his hobby horses into the issue. But I think maybe it's because I studied a lot of political theory in college, but I view it from an ideological and political theory perspective. You have a kind of illiberal left style of thought that when it has the chance to impose its own rules and norms on the discourse, will do so. And the only place where it can really do that, because in the country as a whole, there aren't very many far left people. Even liberals are a minority in the country as a whole. So to find a community where the far left can really dominate, you need to really go into a sub-community, and academia is one of the few places where that can happen.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Charity on the line from Austin, Texas. Charity, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. I wanted to say that I'm out of college. I went to UT, but I'm 25, so memories are pretty vivid. And I think that this is more than just about hurt feelings. I'm also an African-American lesbian. So, I mean, you know, I feel like there's a very real threat sometimes when it comes to harmful speech that just because this one, you know, person who might perform a speech like on campus or something like that isn't, you know, being harmful themselves, they can absolutely, incite harmful speech. And I think that should be looked at. I don't necessarily think this is something that, I think it's behind like a mask of liberalism, what the University of Chicago has come out with. And I think it needs to be reexamined personally, just because I don't think it should be chalked up to hurt feelings. As a woman, as an African American, as a lesbian, I absolutely respect spaces. I respect free speech. I respect protesters. But I don't put up with harmful speech, because I think it's just a way for those in power to maintain power. That's all I have to say about that.
Thanks, Charity. Cosmo?
Yeah, I think what both Charity and Alex said do have some salience for me. I think that, you know, on the University of Chicago campus, there has been a really rigorous conversation about campus climate. And frankly, you know, there's been stunning reports put out by administrators detailing the way in which minority students and women feel isolated, feel attacked, feel discriminated against, you know, on campus. And I think that what this letter does is it sort of dismisses all of those very legitimate, real concerns as being threats to academic freedom. And to me, you know, that's ludicrous, because I think that these are real concerns that need to be addressed. And beyond that, I think it goes the extra step of trying to delegitimize any kind of student dissent or any kind of student protest, be it about free speech or be it about, you know, racial profiling by campus police forces, be it about student loan debt, be it about mental health care, which is significantly lacking at the university. So what the letter does is it sort of takes all of those grievances that students have and it packages them all as illegitimate and says that any attempt to express political speech that the university doesn't like and that university administrators don't like, the people in power, as Charity said, you know, is not welcome at the university, and that the types of speech that are welcome are the types of speech that university administrators are comfortable with, because they're the ones who are able to ultimately set the tone and the rules of any kind of debate or any kind of discussion on campus.
All right, let's take it. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I read the letter, and I just don't see any single passage in there that would suggest anything that what you just said is part of their message whatsoever. I don't see anything that says we don't want you to protest, or protest is wrong, or will be limited in any way. Can you quote a line in the letter
but I can say that the University of Chicago has a quite a long history of suppressing political speech that they don't like. You know, they did it, you know, this past spring when we had a sit-in at the administrative building. You know, our student body president was threatened with expulsion back in the 1960s when, you know, Bernie Sanders and you know, dozens of other alums, you know, sat in on the administration building. You know, there were over 40 students expelled from the University of Chicago for protesting at the administration building over, I believe it was, racist housing practices at the University of Chicago, right? And so this history that the university has of being the sole arbitrator of you know, what constitutes legitimate speech on campus ultimately result in students who have minority viewpoints being sanctioned for, you know, yes, disrupting, but, you know, protest is inherently disruptive, right? And I think that that's something that has to be considered when we have this conversation,
guys,
you know, since the university has a history of suppressing speech.
I want to get to another call. We've got Scott on the line from Burlington, Vermont. Scott, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Thank you very much, John. Kind of off the topic that you were just speaking about, it's looking at this idea of triggering and political correctness, not just at the university level, but as it's kind of manifesting itself throughout society. I have a 13-year-old daughter who will often these days respond to admonishments like, "Are you going to do your homework?" or "Nice job on the dishes last night," with, "Oh, Papa, you're triggering me." And she's not getting this. She's getting this from her junior high school. And so these concepts and ideas are filtering their way down throughout entirely different demographic than the elite universities, much as a prior caller pointed out. And I just want to observe that the reaction of a 13-year-old girl, who's pretty normal, is to laugh at it. And I certainly encourage that. I think we want to be able to laugh at everything before we really get down and think about it. She's going to have to be thinking about this in a few years. But do you think that we have trivialized this? And because I do believe we have the rating systems for movies, triggering is something that is part of our society. We name it different things. But where is this all going? Where are we going to see this hit in high schools, junior high schools? And is it just going to be the area? I mean, is this just a focus for scared administrators?
Scott, that's a great point. And let me put it to Stephanie Green. Stephanie, are you concerned that the way that the cause that you're advocating, the concerns that you're advocating, are going to turn into a joke?
Yes. So I think like we're kind of already seeing that now with like the University of Chicago administration. And I think what the previous caller Charity brought up was kind of spot on. So, it's not about hurt feelings. And I think when we turn kind of the need for trigger warnings or safe spaces into an issue of hurt feelings, that's where we kind of get into trouble. And that's where we start kind of dismissing students' needs and the university gets away with not having to deal with campus climate issues. So, I mean, in thinking about, you know, free speech and freedom of expression, you know, like Charity said, right, it's a way for those in power to stay in power because, you know, hurtful language really ends up hurting groups that are already hurting, right? So, you know, it's just this huge cycle that is perpetuated by a university that says that anything goes up until the point that, you know, break the law.
I want to illustrate one of the issues that Jonathan was talking about and we've been talking about throughout the show, and it has to do with what happens when speakers come to campus. This is something that happened last May when former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was the commencement speaker at Scripps College, where, full disclosure, my daughter happens to go, at an all-women's graduation. Many students protested, and here's how student Namrata Mohan explained the protest.
She said a lot of very problematic things in the past years. She had kind of very pro-war foreign policy tactics. And she's also, quote-unquote, known as a white feminist. More than her own race or gender, it's rather, is what she's saying, inclusive to everyone.
Jonathan Chait, how representative is that kind of protest to what you've written about and what we've seen at campuses across the country?
I think there's been quite a bit of that, and I think it illustrates some of the problem with the logic that your last caller and a couple of the other guests have tried to explain. They say that speech that marginalizes people who don't have power deprives them of free speech, and so it's not really free speech or shouldn't be permitted as free speech. But once you give people the power to rule out speech on those grounds, there's no logical limits to their to the way that power is used. So it's not just going to be used against the most offensive expressions. It's not just going to be used against Nazis. It's not just going to be used against Donald Trump. It's not just going to be used against the right. It'll just be used not that even that would be acceptable, but you have to understand that there's an inherent creep that this power takes, and then it's Madeleine Albright, the Democratic first Secretary of State, first female Secretary of State. So that's the whole reason why liberals constructed political ideals that try to give people individual rights that can't be taken away on the grounds of who they are.
Let's take another call. We've got Randy on the line from Corydon, Indiana. Randy, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Hi, John. What I would like to point out is that there are times when this political correctness becomes tyrannical. And it really doesn't help. We can't grow as people, as individuals, if we are unwilling to question our own beliefs. And to get that perspective from other people, and it's really important in terms of questioning your beliefs.
I take your point, Randy, and I want to put it to Cosmo Albrecht. Do you think, Cosmo, that political correctness has become tyrannical on campuses?
No, I really don't think so. I think the media has blown this narrative out of proportion that millennials, that college students, you know, are unable to confront ideas that they don't like, are unable to challenge their own beliefs. You know, polling has shown by and large that students want to be at a university where everyone is welcome to speak, where we don't uninvite speakers who are controversial. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. I think that we should welcome the open exchange of ideas. Where I think I diverge from that a little bit, and where I would push back, on the caller's point, is just that, you know, I think in practice at the university, while, you know, the dean and other administrators may want to uphold free speech and uphold academic freedom in theory, there is not this follow-up on the part of administrators when it comes to, communicating with students about issues that are being discussed, on campus. So when it comes to student government, for instance, we have very little communication with administrators. They seem to be the ones who are running away from the ideas that we want to challenge, that they possess, right? And so I think that there's this double standard that's being applied when college students, refuse to challenge an idea in an isolated incident. We're coddled and we're entitled, but when administrators run away from students who are airing legitimate grievances about student quality of life issues, about the rising cost of tuition, et cetera, they're, just doing their job.
Got it.
And to
double
me, that
standard.
Strikes me as ridiculous.
Jonathan, let me ask you a quick answer before we run out of time. What is the relation between political correctness as we're discussing it now on campuses and the political correctness that Donald Trump talks about on the campaign trail?
Well, Donald Trump bashes ISIS, and you can say that his ideas about ISIS are bad, but you don't have to conclude that ISIS is necessarily good. So just because Donald Trump bashes political correctness and does it in a stupid and overbroad way, you don't have to conclude that we should be for political correctness.
Jonathan Chait, thanks so much. I appreciate your joining us.
Thank you.
Stephanie Green, senior majoring in English at the University of Chicago, thank you.
Thank you.
And Cosmo Albrecht, junior, majoring in public policy at the University of Chicago. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot, John.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Donald Trump meets with Mexico's president and then delivers a major speech on immigration. We'll dive in. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.